part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Mark, how are you doing?
Christian Horn, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing all right. Do you realize it's been 2 years since we chatted that last time?
You know, I know it now because when I got the Skype up, it had your anime Captain America logo.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. I drew that myself.
All right.
Yeah. I was looking at the previous podcast and I was like, wow, it's been 2 years. And it was just really nice to get your email and thank you for remembering me. And it was a really nice chat last time. So let's replicate it this time.
Sure, we'll do it again.
All right, let's start off by just saying that this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I have a very special returning guest. I really enjoy his work. He was on here 2 years ago for a book that he wrote called Holly Jolly, which was basically like a very fun look at like the history of Christmas, the history of like the holidays. It was a great conversation. I learned a lot. And now, your name is Mark Voger. I should say that. Oops. I don't want to forget that. But now you've come out. Is the book out right now? Or we kind of like emailed about that, or is it coming out?
No, it's out.
It's out.
Yeah. For once it's early. Yeah.
That's awesome. I didn't think it was going to be until like next week or something, but I guess it's already out, huh?
Yeah. They're showing up in places. I heard from a couple of readers. So, and I got a box. So it exists in the real world now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, you are Mark Voger, correct? The pronunciation is correct. And the book is Britmania, which looks like a really fun, I was checking it out and it's being published by Tomorrows, right? So, people can check out sort of like a preview of it on the Tomorrow's website, tomorrows.com, if you want to take a look. That's what I was doing. And this looks like another really fun kind of like encyclopedic, tome that you've written. I say encyclopedic, that makes it sound like it's not fun, but I did say it's fun. So either way, this is sort of like a look at the history of British pop. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, Christian, and there's interest in it now ever since Peter Jackson's docudrama, The Beatles Get Back.
Oh, yeah.
So popular, and there's a exhibit at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum in Cleveland about it, and so there's interest in this music, but the interest never died. Like, new generations are always discovering these bands, the Beatles, the Stones, the animals, the zombies, like they just keep coming back, not even with parental prodding. They'll find a cool song and then they'll do a deep dive. And next thing you know, they like this really old music. It's 60 years old now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, that was the thing. I didn't get a chance to watch the whole Beatles documentary because it's like 6 hours long and it came out like right at Christmas. I still want to get back to it at some point. From what I did see, I really enjoyed it. And you mentioned like young people discovering this stuff. I mean, my daughter's 15 and she's been a big Beatles fan since forever because I love the Beatles. But there is also this show in the morning here, and I'm blanking out on the radio station, it's like 2 or 3 hours of just straight Beatles on Saturday morning. It's like incredible. And all he does is play like Beatles songs or like solo songs by the Beatles and Beatles influenced music. So it's just like really cool that it's kind of like, I mean, obviously the Beatles will be alive forever, but that this sort of thing is kind of like still going strong, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing that it has been, I think, interesting for people who are new to it is everybody knows the Beatles, but the story of how they came over to America and just took America by storm, and then all these other bands like the Rolling Stones, the Who, the Kinks, one after another, the Beatles opened the floodgates, and so all these A&R men at record companies were desperately trying to sign the next big British act. So right up through like the late 60s, all the Britmania just like really caught on, and all these groups, these new groups, were putting out this amazing music that is actually kind of timeless, still relevant, still sounds fresh today.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the sort of fascinating thing. I mean, I'm kind of a bit of a history buff. I like to watch documentaries. I like to, you know, read like books and historical things when I can. But one of the things that's always fascinated me about this sort of thing is just like how, like, what was it that opened up in America to British artists for them to just sort of like take over the pop culture scene? I guess I want to say easily, but I don't want to make it seem like, oh, it was, you know, it just happened, but there must have been something, right? Because from everything that I've read or documentaries that I've watched, it was just like, well, they called it the British invasion for a reason, right?
Yeah. And it was, nothing does happen overnight and nothing does happen easily. They really paid their dues. I mean, right before they first, the big bang was February 9, 1964, a Sunday night, when they played, they debuted on American television live on the Ed Sullivan Show. And but already the pump was primed. Their Meet the Beatles album was out. They had hit singles. Girls were already ready to scream in America. What happened was they had over a 2-year period previously, they had this meteoric rise in England, and so it got to the point where people were saying like, "Wow, who are these four lads from Liverpool who are playing in a cellar in Liverpool, next a cellar club, the Cavern Club, and then the next thing you know, they're the biggest thing in England." So Sullivan found out about it. A gentleman named Sid Bernstein booked them to play Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. And then they were coming over anyway, so Sullivan put them on. And ratings were his god, and he even though he didn't understand it probably because he was from a different generation, he knew that the ratings, you know, ratings are king. So he put them on, and I will mention that initially, the entertainment establishment was hostile toward the Beatles.
Oh, really?
Oh, sure. Like when Dean Martin put the Rolling Stones on Hollywood Palace one time, after they came off, he just like rolled his eyes, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it took them a long time to warm up. The press was hostile to them. Columnists were putting them down. Columnists at newspapers all over America were putting them down. Even like Newsweek and Saturday Evening Post, and they were just really said bad things about them. But eventually these guys won them over because they were charming, they were funny, and nothing threw them because of their Liverpudlian senses of humor. Uh-huh. And also they had just finished being heckled by drunk German sailors for 2 years playing in Hamburg. So they could handle any audience. So when the journalists threw them those nasty questions, they just answered with better sarcasm.
gotcha. But I mean, the Beatles is one thing, right? Like, because they eventually became the Beatles, right? They influenced pretty much everyone that came after them. But what is it that opens up the floodgates to other British? Is it just that they were popular and people were like, I just want that? Like, I want more of that. Is that sort of like what happened? Or like, what is it that, you know, because I mean, that's sort of one of the fascinating things, has always been one of the fascinating things for me, is like, how do we go from Elvis, you know, and Chuck Berry and stuff like that to the Beatles and then all these other British artists where they kind of just kind of take over the pop music scene in the 60s. What is it about that era you think that was just so welcoming to it?
Well, the funny thing is, well, first of all, the Beatles and all the British guys, they their idols were Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry.
Sure.
And Little Richard, people like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but they, I interviewed a gentleman named Terry Sylvester, who was in the Swingin' Blue Jeans. He was a guy from Liverpool, and he was later in the Hollies. And he said that after the Beatles became such a big hit. He said that if you'd be walking down the street, a car might pull up to you, and it was talent scouts saying, like, "Hey, you have a good look. Do you sing?" Like, they're actually running around Liverpool trying to just sign anybody. That everybody was looking for the next big thing.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Tellingly, the name of the Rolling Stones' first album in America was the Rolling Stones' England's Newest Hitmakers, because they really wanted to get that out, get that across, that if you love the Beatles, you know, you'll probably love the Rolling Stones or the Who or the Kinks. So, but you know, the music was good. You know, that was another thing, is that it was not just an explosion, of popularity, but also like talent. You know, and they were good performers. You know, like Jagger, Brian Jones. They had something. They had charisma.
Yeah.
The Who was just a live act, you know, first, I think, before becoming a studio band, you know?
Wow. I mean, it's interesting to me. Like, I mean, it's always been fascinating to me, like I said earlier, how it just kind of took over. For you, like, what is your first sort of, was it the Beatles? Was the Beatles the thing that kind of like dragged you into this sort of music, or was it a different band, or like what was your sort of first introduction to sort of, I guess, what I call it, Britpop?
Well, it's funny you should ask, Christian. I did have a moment. I was very lucky. What happened was in 1964, I was 5 years old.
Oh, okay.
And when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, I never would have seen it. Because, you know, I was only five, and I was probably watching Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, which was on the other network. But what happened was our backdoor neighbors, my babysitter, her name was Debbie, came like banging on the door, on the back door, with two of her girlfriends saying, "Let us in, let us in. We have to watch the Beatles." I thought their TV, in my memory, their TV had broken.
Yeah.
So there I was in my pajamas, 5 years old. And three girls are in my living room, and they're watching. I don't know what's going on. They're watching the Beatles, and they're screaming. And I did not understand it, but I realized later in life that if that hadn't happened, I would have missed that moment of like the Beatles' debut. And then I'll add, Christian, that I ran into Debbie 40 years later at her father's funeral, and I said, "Hey, remember that time the TV went bad?" And she said, "No, the TV was fine. But my father was watching a football game. There was no way he was going to change the channel. So, we wound up coming over to your place. But and then I won't belabor it. But after the Beatles, they were always on the radio. There was a Saturday morning cartoon series called The Beatles where they played their actual songs. So even if you were little, they had stuffed toys and lunchboxes that were marketed to you.
Sure. So, I mean, everyone knows the Beatles, everyone knows the Stones. I mean, people know the Zombies and stuff like that. What are some of the, more obscure sort of bands that you might have been into that maybe people might not know about from the British invasion or that sort of thing?
Well, I think that the younger people who, you know, weren't alive in the 60s, I think they respond to like bands that sort of still have what sounds like an edge, like the Animals, for instance.
Yeah.
We've got to get out of this place. You know, like songs like that they sound real. They sound emotional. There's something almost like punk rock about the way Eric Burdon sings on those songs. He sounds like a tortured soul. The Kinks, You Really Got Me. There aren't many songs that are so raw as You Really Got Me. It just like I said, it almost sounds like punk rock. And then the Who, like, these are bands that have like a timeless appeal to kids, and I think they find them. And you know, the funny thing is, Ringo Starr, his son, I'm blanking out on his name, Zach, his son Zach Starkey, followed in his father's footsteps and became a drummer. But the Beatles wasn't his band. The Who was his band because of the furious drumming of Keith Moon. He just really, really responded to that. And he became the Who's drummer, you know, like to this day, I think when they go out, like he's the most consistent guy to go out with them as, as their drummer.
Oh, wow. That's so crazy. That's so crazy. So you're like 5 years old when this breaks. I mean, when do you sort of, I mean, obviously you wrote a book about it. So when did you sort of like fall in love with this? I mean, you're 5 years old, the DNA is planted. I'm just surprised that you weren't freaked out by three girls like just like rummaging into your house and like screaming at the TV all of a sudden as a five-year-old, like, what is happening? What is going on? This is terrifying to me. But like, obviously, so you're five and you're lucky enough to see the Beatles first. Like, do you remember the performance, or you just remember the girls coming in?
I really just remember the girls coming in.
Okay.
But like I said, that Saturday morning cartoon that they started like a little less than a year later. And and the funny thing about that cartoon was they used real Beatles songs. You can see them all over YouTube.
Yeah.
So for instance, there's a song called Babies in Black, and it's a lot of people know it, but it's not like, you know, one of their huge, huge hits. But the first time I ever heard that song, it was on the Beatles cartoon show. And it was an episode where they were the Mona Lisa was stolen and the Beatles were rescuing it. So the Mona Lisa in the story was the baby in black. She was the baby in black. And so to this day, when I hear Babies in Black, I don't think of it as side one, track three from Beatles for Sale. I think of it as a song from a cartoon show. And on that point, my mind cannot be changed.
That's so funny, because that was your first exposure to it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So at about 6 or 7 years old, right?
Yeah. But like I said, it was the weirdest thing. It's really what a lot of my book Brit Mini is about, because it's very like it's very visual, and I have a section on memorabilia. But the Beatles were not necessarily a child friendly band.
Uh-huh.
They were, you know, but the marketing people just thought the Beatles are the biggest thing, so they made dolls and, like I said, lunch boxes.
Mm-hmm.
and bubble bath toys. There were Beatles bubble bath toys, and like all kinds of stuff. There were ice cream bars. I mean, there's all kinds of Beatles memorabilia or collectibles that were sold at the time that were marketed straight to children. And so that got a little awkward later in the 60s when all of these groups were still recording, but they were starting to experiment with hallucinogenics, and they were growing out their hair, and they're growing, you know, handlebar mustaches or whatever.
Yeah.
And music was getting real psychedelic, and their clothes and their lifestyle were getting like, you know, kind of weird. So that was confusing when you were now in the middle 60s and you're in grade school and you're, you know, a little bit older, but these guys that you used to watch on Saturday morning cartoons just a year or two ago, all of a sudden now they're doing like all this weird stuff, you know, but it all made sense in the end.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that is interesting to me as far as like the Beatles or even like Elvis. My understanding from something I watched a while ago is that at the time, and this may be particular to the Beatles, and, you know, we're just focusing on the Beatles, I guess they're the biggest band, at least in my mind. But that, back then, if you were sort of that kind of pop star, like, it was viewed as a very sort of short-lived existence, right? It's like maybe you came out with a couple of records and maybe you were popular, but nobody really thought that like a band like that or like Elvis would have like any real longevity, right? That they would be recording like 10, 15, 20 years later. Am I correct about that?
Oh, absolutely, Christian. Like when the Beatles made their first movie, A Hard Day's Night, that schedule was super tight because they were worried, the producers were worried that the Beatles would be like, you know, like one-hit wonders.
Mm.
So they wanted to rush that movie out because they just wanted to cash in while it was hot. And another thing that's really weird, I'm guessing you're a comic book guy because you're...
Oh,
you're
Captain America. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know if you know the old caricaturist. I'm thinking of people like Frank Frazetta, and he's much more than a caricaturist.
Yeah.
Mort Drucker and Jack Davis. You know,
Magazine guys, right?
Yeah, all the Mad Magazine guys.
Yeah,
well, they all at the beginning they all took pot shots at the Beatles, right?
Okay,
but some of them didn't bother. Like because they were World War II generation, they thought this was a flash in the pan. They didn't bother to try to capture their likenesses. They drew like kind of generic Beatle characters.
Like with the haircuts, right? Like the
mop. The haircuts. And one of them, they always got Ringo because Ringo was always the punchline, the guy with the big nose.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure I've seen this stuff. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So for instance, Drucker, Mort Drucker, when he did the Beatles in Mad, he nailed them. He got them. Frazetta, same thing. But Jack Davis, who is a master, and a gentleman named Angelo Torres, who's also a master, when they took their first cracks at the Beatles, they didn't bother to research them and find out what they looked like to in order to draw them. And one guy I'll mention, not to go too deep into the comic book rabbit hole, but I'm sure you know Joe Sinnott, who inked
of course,
like 100 issues of Fantastic Four.
Yeah, he recently passed, right?
Yeah. Chiefly by Jack Kirby and John Buscema. Well, he illustrated the Adele Comics official giant Beatles comic book. Uh-huh. And man, did they, he's mostly known as an inker, but he's a fantastic artist, a penciler. And so he penciled that thing. And honestly, Christian, he really nailed the Beatles. Like, you open that book, he got their instruments and he got their backgrounds. He killed himself on this book. It was kind of his specialty to do, like, because he did a lot of history books, like, Abraham Lincoln or FDR or Martin Luther King. I mean, I'm just spitballing, but stuff like that, you know. And so he really, so yeah, it was hot and cold in those days. They even some of the masters like Davis and Torres did not bother to really research them, because they just thought these guys are here today and gone later today.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that I can't remember. Must have been some documentary a while ago where I was just like, oh, back then there was no, they were not, like, this sort of thing wasn't considered to have, like, a long lifespan. I mean, I understand that, like, when it comes to, like, certain actors and stuff like that. But it seemed like, in general, it was like, yeah, you come out with an album or two and then you're done. Not that you would still be doing it and be trailblazing at it. You know, I mean, like, changing things, you know, forever for the future in the long run. So it's just kind of fascinating to me, like, that the Beatles, the Stones, you know, the Who and all that, like, actually changed the face of everything. What is it that you think about British pop musicians at the time, like, made them so innovative or interested in experimenting in things as time went on? Like, do you have any insight as to that?
Well, yeah, I think in the case of the Beatles, they had an extremely powerful enabler in the person of George Martin, their erstwhile producer. And so they, what he said about them, he throws the credit right back to them, though. He said they never repeated themselves. He said they if you have a hit single, the record company would say, like, yeah, we want one just like it, you know, so that we can, you know, get the same money. But, you know, but it never helps your longevity. But the Beatles, George Martin said, like, they were always reaching. So he was also a terrific arranger. Strings were a specialty. So the more that the Beatles would say, like, we want to try this, we want to try that, he was able to make that happen, you know. And one thing I remember him saying, I attended a lecture of his, and he just said, somebody like Paul McCartney would say, could we have a French horn there? And could it go do 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 do? Like, he would have the part kind of in his head, and he would sing it out to George Martin.
Oh, wow.
Whereas John Lennon might say, put a green thing over it, you know, like a very vague directive, you know. And then over at the Stones camp, they had a gentleman named Brian Jones. They called him a guitarist, but really he was a multi-instrumentalist. He played, he was the guy, everybody says it, you gave him any instrument and within an hour he'd have something that he could play on it. So for instance, if you can remember the song Paint It Black, and it has that sitar on it, you know, he played that, you know. He played harmonica on the early Stones songs, you know. He crashed and burned. They had to fire him out of the band, and then he didn't live much longer after that, you know. Died tragically. Uh-huh. But man, when he created so much fantastic music, and he was somebody who also, like the Beatles and like George Martin, pushed the boundaries.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, but I guess, is it something in, because I mean, that's sort of a discussion I've had with, like, I used to be an actor a long time ago. I pursued acting, right? And one of the sort of discussions that I eventually have with I live in Los Angeles, so you throw a rock and you meet, like, entertainment people, right? So not stars or anything, but people who are involved in on one level or the other, you know what I'm saying? Behind the camera, sure. Whatever. And the discussion always kind of turns, like, to, like, why are so many British actors kind of like being hired in American movies? You know what I mean? And one of my sort of explanations always tends to be, and I've talked about this a little bit on the podcast when we discuss movies or things like that, is that, you know, they sort of have like a social net and a respect for theater, and, you know, they pay for education, they pay for healthcare. So maybe there's less stress in like trying to pursue that kind of career. My thinking is like thinking about this era, it's the 60s. So everyone's kind of coming out of like the wreckage of like maybe World War II. So maybe there's a bit more angst and anger in the music, or a desire to do things differently. Is your thinking anywhere along that same lines, or like as far as like how it just captured the imagination and just transformed everything?
Well, yeah, absolutely, Kristen, because most of these musicians were what I call blitz babies. They they were born, you know, like Keith Richards always says that, you know, his family abode was bombed, but they weren't home. And he in his autobiography, Life, he writes that he said a brick or two landed in my cot. And he said, wow. When he hears a siren, to this day, the hair stand up on the back of his neck. But yeah, a lot of these guys do remember the Blitz. You know, Graham Nash had to be evacuated from the town he grew up in to be born at a to be they would evacuate the pregnant ladies, and so they could have their babies in peace and then come back. Blackpool, I think it was.
Yeah.
And so World War II, and so even the kids, even the British musicians who might not have remembered the actual bombings, they grew up in playing in rubble, and they grew up with rationing. So, so they did have these kind of affected existences. Also, by and large, not in every case, but they all came from a lot of the British invasion musicians came from areas that back then you might have called rough and tumble, such as Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham, Shepherd's Bush, places that, you know, they always say, we didn't know we were poor. There was food, and on the table, there was happiness in the house, but they weren't posh Brits, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Some of them were, a few here and there. So that's, I think, gave them a relatability that, if they were like the posh Brits, like I say, I was at Knightsbridge, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
They were more relatable, and also here's one more thing. They idolized the not just the rock and roll guys like Chuck Berry and Little Richard, but they also idolized the old blues masters, people like Big Bill Brunzi and Sonny Williamson, and so people like Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page, who were in the Yardbirds. They, and certainly Keith Richards and Brian Jones of the Stones, they knew these old blues masters, and they thought when they came to America that, you know, that we would all know them. But they found out that we didn't know the old blues masters, because they never got their due here, respect wise or monetarily. So what the British guys did was they covered that music. They were influenced by that music, so they were kind of regurgitating it to us.
Yeah.
And then two things happen. Just that in England, when a mania for all things British like took over the world, like you said, they'd crawled slowly out of World War II for the past 15 years. So now they had a spring back in their step, because between the Beatles and James Bond and all their television exports, Britishness itself was you know, hip again.
Yeah.
And one other thing here, people forget, but when the Beatles debuted on Ed Sullivan in February of 1964, JFK had just been assassinated the previous November. We were a nation in mourning, and these Beatles came along and they took our minds off of it. So absolutely, you're absolutely correct about that.
Wow. Well, let me ask you a quick question, and not to delve into anything too weird or political, but like, how does sort of like cultural appropriation kind of like fit into that? I mean, you mentioned the blues artists, and we all know why they weren't respected in this country, right? I mean, we don't have to like outwardly say it, racism, but we all know. But I mean, my question is like, as far as like the British artists kind of like being influenced by them or covering a lot of their stuff or sort of like adapting that music for their own needs, like, has there been any sort of discussion as towards that thing? Like, is it just because it was imported to their country, it might be seen in a different way?
Well, it's a bit of a complicated answer, but
sure.
I will say this, like, for instance, the black blues masters from America prior to the British invasion would tour Europe, would tour England, and some of the British invasion musicians would be their backup band. So, for instance, guys in the Small Faces, particularly Ian McLagan, who was their keyboardist, he backed up some of these guys. A gentleman named John Mayall backed up some of these guys. The Beatles were a backup band for Little Richard in Hamburg. You know, so in other words, they already had contact. You know, and also the Beatles and the Stones. At every opportunity during interviews, they would say, these are the guys that you should that you should be listening to, you know. And I know that Spencer Davis of the Spencer Davis Group, one time he said he was playing, I'm trying to think of the song he was playing, but some American, he was in Paris playing a song, and some American tourists walked by and said, oh, you're doing a Weavers song. The Weavers being a folk vocal group at the time. Uh-huh. And he said, no, this is not a Weaver song. This is a Huddy Ledbetter song. So it was one of the songs that was by one of the old blues masters, but the Weavers covered it, you know. So they were really helping to shine a light back on. There's an adorable story about B.B. King where he was booked by Billy Graham to play Fillmore West in the late 60s.
Oh.
So he shows up. You know, he's got his band, he's got his suit on, he always wore his suit. But he looked out, he peeked out into the audience, and he saw that it was all young white kids, you know, for the most part. And he's like, and he goes to Bill, and he says, you know, I think I'm here on the wrong night. You know, that's not my audience. And Bill Graham says, like, B, they're all here for you. You know, they actually did, everybody did, you know, get a moment in the sun again. But I talked to Bo Diddley, and Bo Diddley, the creator of the Bo Diddley beat, he kind of thought that every song that ever had that beat, dunk, da dunk, da dunk, da dunk, dunk, that Bo Diddley beat, he thought that he wrote it, you know. Is there a song by Bruce Springsteen, Still the One? I forget. There's a song where Springsteen uses it. There's a song with Who uses it. I think that's Magic Bus. So he would just say, oh, yeah, they stole it from me, you know. So sometimes that would happen. But for the most part, I think it was a mutually beneficial. The British guys love those old blues masters, you know?
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, let me ask you about the book itself, because I mean, I did go to tomorrows.com. And, you know, I went through, it's a little preview that you can like blow up full size and flip through some pages and stuff. And it's very colorful and stuff like that. I mean, the sort of, just quickly when I was looking through it, is this book like the sort of British invasion as it relates to our pop culture and comics and stuff like that? Or is it, like, I mean, is it both? Is it like a history of like what, how it happened, when it happened, who were the players, and how it just kind of like touched everything?
Yeah, it's definitely both, Christy. What happened is I designed the book as well, so it's
Oh wow, really?
Yeah, so it's very visual, and so that's really important to me. So it
Yeah,
does
yeah,
have
yeah.
like a big section on the British musicians when they would be in comic books. I mean, the Beatles were depicted in both DC and Marvel comic books in the 60s.
Yeah,
It's
yeah.
really crazy. They were also depicted in Archie, you know, Dell books, Charlton romance books. It was really
Yeah.
crazy. They had this big, like, weird, you know, probably unlicensed, you know, career in the comics. Also, like I mentioned earlier, all the memorabilia, all the toys and the trading cards and everything. So I have sections on all that. But there is a great deal of supporting editorial. Like I interviewed members of just about every major British Invasion band. Like I talked to members of the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, the Kinks, the Animals, the Zombies.
Wow, how did you get those interviews? That's amazing.
Oh no, it's lots of fun. The short story long is just that I spent 40 years in newspapers as a graphic artist and entertainment writer. So over the years, I went after everybody. I'm talking about, you know, the comic book guys that you and I know, like Jack Kirby and you know, Ross Andrew and Kurt Swan, whoever. And but I'd go after TV people. I went after a lot of these British Invasion guys. So I do have interviews with every major. The only two that I didn't get members of that I regret is the Dave Clark Five and Jerry and the Pacemakers. But other than that, I have like real quotes that I really got myself putting questions, you know, to the horse's mouth of these people. So the way I do it is I just show how the Beatles came up, their story about the beginnings in Liverpool and those 2 years in Hamburg and then taking America by storm. And then I do a section where I do all the bands. So I do, you know, the Stones, the Who and everybody. And then we get into the fun stuff. We get into the TV and the comics and all the really fun pop culture stuff that is so visual.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, from just perusing through it online, I was just like, oh, this looks great. I mean, there's just a lot of like crazy stuff in there. And I was just like, oh wow, this is so much fun. I mean, it's a lot like your last book, like Holly Jolly. I mean, it's just like very well presented, and it's like a cornucopia of just like all the visuals and the posters and the, you know, on the cover, you've got like costume masks and stuff like that. You know, I mean, it just all looks like really great. And it's all laid out in a very sort of like nostalgic way, in my opinion, like a very like, oh, it would appeal to the people who grew up with this and also to the new crowd who are just discovering it. It's very well, it's a very visually appealing book.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Christian. But yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. It's, in other words, in design, there's something that we call multiple points of entry. That expression is also used in adult films. But what? In other words,
oh, geez,
in other words, it's visual, and this is the kind of book you don't have to read it from the start to the finish. You can just look through it and then spend some time with this page. You know, it's very visual. So you can pretty much start reading it anywhere, you know, but I apologize for that, but
no, that's fine. I love it.
But it's, yeah, no. So that's the whole point. And I'm hoping, you know, like I'm that it isn't just for, you know, aging boomers, but it's also for the kids, you know, cause it is visual more than anything, a visual trip.
That's great. That's great. So let me ask you this question, because like, so I'm not a big music nerd. Like, I don't know everything about music. I love all kinds of music. I like my daughter is always like, when I put the shuffle on my phone, because I have like my music library on my phone, because I have like an SD card and it's got whatever, how many gigs, right? And it's all kinds of like different crazy music, right? And from all different eras. But the thing of it is that like, I'm not a music nerd. Like, I don't know the history of everything. I don't know the ins and outs. I don't know the members of the band, even from bands that I grew up with, right, that I like now. Like, I've never really done like a deep dive into music. I just like lots of different things. My favorite is jazz for some reason. I don't know. I've always just liked it, maybe because I grew up on the East Coast in New York and New Jersey, and it's relaxing to me. But I mean, for me, when I was young, it was like I had to focus my nerddom on like one thing, and that was like comics, like and movies, like TV and stuff like that. You know, TV was free back then. You know, you could watch the $6 Million Man or whatever, reruns of Three's Company, you know, and comics. But it sounds to me like you like have been into this like from the beginning. You were more like of a normal kid that like liked the music and you know what I mean? Like the stuff that girls would pay attention to. Like, you know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, yeah, no, I've always been, you know, kind of obsessed with media. I was a nerd. I was a terrible athlete growing up.
Oh, join the club. Yeah.
Yeah. So I escaped into media, and that was, so comic books and Sunday funnies, you know, like in the newspapers, that's how I learned to read, was the funnies really. And so comic books and the show Batman, you know, with Adam West was like, I was primed, I was 7 years old.
When sure.
That was like my religion. And so, yeah, I loved monster movies, you know. So it was all like, so I was a media junkie, you know. And the Beatles, I mean, that movie that I mentioned earlier, The Hard Day's Night,
yeah,
that is as important to the Beatles' legacy as Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's a comic masterpiece. It's such a charming movie. I put it right up there with, you know, The Godfather and Wizard of Oz, and you know, like it's just like one of the great movies, you know.
Yeah.
And that started actually the critics to finally liking the Beatles. But yeah, so I loved it all. I loved music, and I know when I was a kid, I didn't know who was drawing. You know, I didn't know that was Kurt Swan who drew Superman that I like so much. I wasn't sophisticated, you know, but then later on I caught up.
Gotcha. It's so funny that you mention A Hard Day's Night, because that's one of the things that like, one of the things that we kind of do on New Year's is like, we'll watch a movie sometimes in the afternoon, like New Year's Day or something. And one year A Hard Day's Night was on Turner Classic Movies, and I kind of would like pulled it up and watched it with my daughter. And my daughter didn't really know, she was little, she didn't really know anything about the Beatles or that much about the band or anything like that. She obviously heard some music maybe in the car, you know, with me and stuff like that. But she loved it. Like as a little kid, like I want to say like maybe 8, you know what I mean? Like not like around that age. And there was something about the Beatles in that movie that just translated for her. And she was like, I was like, did you like that? And she was like, oh, it was great. Like they were funny and it was nice. And you know, she probably had maybe never seen like a black and white movie up until that point, you know? So it's just funny that you mentioned A Hard Day's Night, because it really, I mean, it blew me away how much it translated to my daughter. And, you know, to be honest, for me, I never saw A Hard Day's Night as anything like, you know, historical or anything, except for the fact that, you know, it included the Beatles. And, you know, just seeing my daughter's reaction, I was like, wow, something really worked there.
That's really heartwarming. And I'm not surprised, because like, I think that anybody who's never heard of the Beatles could watch that movie and really that like key in on like the humor and their own little language that they speak to each other and how they're really just goofing on all the stuff that's happening around them. And they were never able to repeat it or top it, you know. Help is not, it was a lame follow-up, and they never made another movie like that. It doesn't seem like you really could. It was like lightning in a bottle, you know. Richard Lester, a Philadelphian emigre in London, is the guy who you know, directed it. And they hired, and I can't think of the gentleman's name, but they hired a Liverpudlian to shadow the Beatles for a couple of days, and he took notes. And so he kind of captured their personalities. John Lennon says it was BS, but honestly, when you watch The Hard Day's Night, it really does seem like John, Paul, George, and Ringo, as you know them from being, you know, on the Mike Douglas show in the 70s or whatever it was, that where you saw them again, he did capture them. I believe with all my heart, you know.
Oh, that's a great. I just looked up the radio show for it's on KCSN in LA. It's hosted by Les Perry, and it's Saturday with the Beatles. It's literally like a 3-hour block of Beatles music every Saturday. And we have it on our radio station, and we'll be driving in the morning and my daughter will be like, oh, is that Saturday with the Beatles? And she won't let me change the station. So it's just like, so they were definitely doing something right, because they've definitely become a favorite with my daughter. What are some of the things that because obviously you were a fan of this before you wrote the book, right? Or before you decided to maybe write this book. What are some of the things that you learned that you didn't know? Like stuff that might have surprised you? Because, you know, I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff, but if you were a fan for years and years and years before you even started writing the book, I would imagine that you might have thought you knew everything, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, definitely anytime you start a project like this, it's a journey of discovery, you know, like there's so much that I learned. But, and even the fact, Christian, that, like I spoke to in the Beatles Hamburg days, those 2 years that they spent in Germany playing for, as I say, drunken German sailors. And
yeah.
They would play all night long. They'd do like 8-hour shows, you know, like, and for 2 years, like I said, they really honed their act there, their live act. They really honed it there. People in the know about the Beatles always say it wasn't the Liverpool that made the Beatles. It wasn't the Cavern Club. It was Hamburg, you know, the clubs they played there. Well, anyway, what I was going to say was, I'd interviewed three people that were, involved in the Beatles Hamburg days. Their first manager, Alan Williams, he's deceased. Tony Sheridan, who sang on the first, sang lead on My Bonnie, which was the first professionally recorded and released single that the Beatles played on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then Pete Best, who was the drummer that got fired after those 2 years in Hamburg, he got fired so they could hire Ringo. So.
Was Pete Best the one that eventually died later on, or like that they made a movie out of, like in the 90s or something? Like
no, Pete's still with us.
Okay.
There was a gentleman who was one of the original Beatles named Stuart Sutcliffe.
Got it. That's it. Yeah. I blanked.
I didn't know that they made a movie about him, but there's a great graphic novel about him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've read that one. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's terrific.
Yeah.
But anyway, Christian, it was the first time that I sat down. Like I'd interviewed this guy maybe 10 years ago, this guy 5 years ago, you know, and I didn't use it all at the time, but I still had it on, in my archives. And by the way, whenever I quote somebody, I always tell you the year that they said it so that you have that as your point.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Context.
And, yeah. But anyway, it was the first time I ever took all of their quotes and put and then researched the story and weaved in their quotes to tell the story. And I was like, oh my God, like they all told me this at different times. I didn't remember it. But then with the exercise of putting this project together, I really got the story like a blow by blow from those guys. So that was really eye opening. You know, all the little stories like, why did they wear black leather during their Hamburg years? Well, Pete Best told me they could never get black leather clothing in England, but they could get it in Hamburg. And the clothes their stage clothes that they showed up in Hamburg with, because of the long hours and the sweat, it would keep falling apart and ripping. They'd sew it together. Finally, they just fell off them. They were just rags. So, but leather you could wear on stage or off. So that
by the time they got back though.
To, oh yeah, well, yeah, trapping all that sweat. So by the time they got back to Liverpool after those 2 years in Hamburg, they were billed as, you know, direct from Germany, the Beatles, you know, and they were swearing on stage, smoking on stage, wearing the black leather. They were a different band than they had been when they left. So that was one of my big revelations, people who are true Beatle nerds have always known this, but I have a different perspective in Britmania because from having spoken to those guys about it, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. What were maybe the most, because like you said, you've done tons of interviews through the years and things like that. What was the hardest thing about putting this book together? Because, I mean, you're basically looking into history, right? And a period of time. What was some of the hardest stuff to get a hold of? What were some of the hardest subjects to maybe get you know, a hang of, like that you wanted to talk about, or you know, that the information might not have been as readily available, or were there any graphics that you couldn't find that you wanted to put in the book, or tchotchkes, you know, like souvenirs? What was the hardest thing for you in putting this book together?
Well, it's funny you asked that, because with all these projects, with this is my, I guess, my fourth one in this pop culture series. The first one was called Monster Mash, about the monster craze of the 50s and 60s. The second one was called Groovy, all about psychedelia. And you have Holly Jolly. So this is the fourth in that series. There's always there's always something I don't have that I have to get. So between you and me, don't tell your listeners, but I bought the Beatles Remco dolls, and I really shelled out for them, $400 for the set. I wanted near mint dolls with good hair and good paint.
Where did you find them?
Well, I got them on eBay.
But, oh, was it eBay? Wow, lucky. Yeah.
But these dolls are so fascinating in person, but I've never seen a photo of them in a book that captures that. So I just said, okay, I'm going to capture it somehow. And I tried all kinds of things. I brought my John Lennon to Manhattan, and I photographed them all over Manhattan as a test, you know. But what finally worked in the end is
you took them out of the box.
No, these guys weren't in boxes.
$1,000
if they were still in the boxes, you know.
Gotcha.
But anyway, so. And then, like, for instance, Frazetta did this amazing portrait of Ringo Starr for a Mad Magazine back cover. It was a parody of Breck shampoo. It was called...
I remember that.
Called Blech, you know.
Yeah, shampoo. I remember that.
And so I didn't have that issue. I had to get that issue, you know. When Mort Drucker did the Beatles, movie parody, I had to get that, you know. So I'd scan stuff, photograph stuff. I wanted to show one of the Beatles trading cards, like full page, you know, it's super impact, you know. So yeah, I had to shell out for stuff. I had some stuff, but I had to shell out for stuff, and it's just such a visual thing. Sure. And then as far as like research, there's always a lesson that comes out after the fact, and I think with this book and with the British Invasion art, that lesson was what I alluded to earlier about the fact that these guys came from modest backgrounds, but they loved the music. So it gave them encouragement. They played it, they put their spin on it, they played it back for us, and it gave us encouragement.
Oh wow. Yeah. I guess kind of like take a hard left there with my next question. I mean, what I'm curious about, is there anything that kind of like disappointed you when you were doing the research, or was there anything that came up for you where you were like, oh wow, that's like a bummer, you know what I mean? Like, or this, you know, like, did people get cheated out of money, or did people like, you know, have rivalries, or like that sort of thing? Did anything come up for you where you were like, that you didn't know, that you were just like, oh man, that sucks?
Well, not so much that I didn't know. I mean, we all know that like Pink Floyd, and people in America think that Pink Floyd began with Dark Side of the Moon, you know, but they actually formed in London in 1964, and they were doing psychedelic songs like, you know, before anybody practically. Uh-huh. But everybody knows that their lead singer and main songwriter, Syd Barrett, just kind of became a casualty. People think that he was probably schizophrenic, and certainly acid was involved. He was frank about that. So the thing that the bummer things that were that to me were those three characters, Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, who is so brilliant and just such a great looking, like a rock star. Also Keith Moon of The Who, there's no drummer like him, you know. He just bottomless pit of talent, and he like Ringo, he arranged songs with his drumsticks, you know, and his kick drum pedals, you know. But these guys died tragically young, and I mean, Sid Barrett died when he was 60, which is still young. But Mooney and Brian Jones, you know, died in what should have been their prime, and so that was the bummer. But there were stories like Chad Stewart of Chad and Jeremy told me that they didn't make any money. You know, like he just said, like, you know, creative accounting. They had all these huge hits, and you know, they didn't make any money. But he said, you know, you can't let that eat you up. You know, now it didn't happen to the Stones because Jagger was actually really always into economics. He was even studying, you know, economics when he.
Oh, really?
Finally, yeah, when he finally, you know, that's when he was Michael Philip Jagger. Yeah. But, so he kept his eyes on the business. But yeah, there are those kind of stories about getting ripped off. I mean, they happen to this day, you know, in all genres of music.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, 60 years later, I mean, one of the things that's always fascinated me about sort of like 20th century history, right? I mean, we're in the 21st century, which is so weird for me to say, but having been born in the 20th century, one of the things that I've always kind of, and I think we're seeing it happening in the world now, like particularly like with European history right now and American history, is what I'd always wondered is what would happen when the greatest generation sort of like kind of like dies out. You know what I'm saying? Like would we remember the lessons of like World War I, World War II, like all the things that kind of people went through, like the tragedies and the horrors and stuff like that? I mean, 60 years later with the British invasion, what do you think, like, obviously it changed the world, right? It changed the way that we like absorb music. I mean, one of the things I kind of wanted to mention earlier is like some of the Beatles stuff, like they started off like Chuck Berry and rock and roll, but some of it got softer as it went along, right? Like it changed. It wasn't necessarily like as hard as it as they started. They might have mellowed out a bit. But I guess my point is like sort of like wrapping this up a bit, I'm not saying my final question because maybe something could pop into my head, but what do you think the legacy of it all is? Like, what is your take on that? I mean, maybe it's a dumb question because I've kind of answered it, but do you think that like 200 years from now, people will still be listening to The Who, like, you know, the Beatles, you know, the Rolling Stones, like stuff like that? Do you think this music will stick around like Mozart?
Yes, I don't know about 200 years from now because I don't know if
I don't maybe know the bugs race will be playing it, Mark.
Yeah, I don't know if the human race is going to last that long.
Yeah,
that much longer. But I guess people have been saying that.
Wow, I thought I was dark. Okay, yeah. go on.
Well, I mean, yeah, like when you get to the point where like what, you know, half the country is flooded and half the country's on fire. I think that we are, you know, the old expression, people who don't know history are doomed to repeat it, you know.
Yeah.
One of the things that the Beatles and those groups did was they flipped the equation in the sense that record companies used to control everything, and they would say, you're going to record now, you're going to do this song, you're going to wear these clothes, and you're going to be on this TV show, whatever. But what Paul McCartney always, he admired Buddy Holly because he said Buddy Holly wrote his own songs, and we thought that was really wild. They were always extremely ambitious, those guys, to write their own songs and to control the publishing and write songs for other people, and they did it throughout the 60s. You know, McCartney gave Peter and Gordon their first hit, you know, and so anyway, and one for Badfinger that Paul wrote, and so in other words, the record companies were kind of they lost that control. It was a very good thing to put more control in the hands of the artist, you know. I don't want to sound like one of these old guys who are saying like these kids today, they use that thing called the harmonizer, and then, you know, and it's just no good, you know. Like,
yeah.
But to me, that like pop music that now, when I hear it, I just think it's the producer who's controlling everything. I think that that there is no real, artistry, that it's like it's a production. And ever since like American Idol or something, something went wrong. But I definitely sound like a dinosaur. but in other words, to me, it's exciting when you do hear somebody who's doing something that sounds different.
I mean, I saw a documentary a while ago that kind of like explained it to me. I think it's called Sound City. It's by what's his face from the Foo Fighters? I'm blanking. Dave Grohl, I believe. Sure. Yeah. What's that?
Oh yeah, no, I said Dave Grohl. Sure.
Yeah. And it was years ago, and it very much encapsulated. A lot of it was about like the human voice and how things have changed because of like, computers and stuff like that, and being in the studio and having to do it multiple times again and again and again, and sort of like trying getting it perfect. And I was very blown away by that, because again, I'm not a musician, not a huge music nerd. I was just like, oh wow, this is the way it worked. And then learning about like auto-tune through other documentaries and things like that I've watched, and I'm just like, wow, the music industry really has changed. And the performance, the live performance aspect isn't maybe necessarily, the live performance aspect in the studio maybe isn't necessarily as important as it used to be.
Yeah. And that's one of the, again, I don't want to make it sound like everybody has their own way in. Right.
Yeah.
But, the Beatles, like I said, those years in Hamburg, the Stones, all of them, they all played these clubs, and they honed their act. And so by the time they got in the studio, all of them say that their first album, what usually, the Who, the Stones, they all say their first album was practically their set from the clubs, and they recorded it in a day or two. And so and then they had to go from there. Their sophomore effort had to have a little more pizzazz to it or something. But and then I ragged on American Idol, but I just thought it got to the point where, like, I think that young people coming up thought that was the way in. It was to, do that mind-blowing vocal and get Simon, whatever his name is, to love you.
Yeah.
And, and it's just what they do now. So like, well, they don't do it anymore. That was like, what, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
I am totally, movies stopped in 74. Music stopped in 78. Comic book stopped in 71.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like,
comic book stopped before I was born? Stop it. 72.
I'm a Silver Age guy. Yeah.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, I mean, from what I've seen of the book, and obviously from what I know of your work and your personality, and you having been on the podcast before, I mean, this book, Britmania, from Tomorrow's Publishing. See, I want to get that in there. You can check it out on tomorrows.com. I mean, everything looks great. And for somebody like me who like really enjoys history and really is interested in knowing like a lot about a lot of little things, you know what I mean? Like, this seems like this is going to be right up my alley. So I cannot wait to get my hands on it and check it out. Do you have any final words you would like to say to any regarding anyone or our listeners about Britmania?
I think we covered it. I mean, just that please, I'd love to hear from you.
Where can people find you?
Yeah, I'll say it because I'd love to. Like I said, my dream is that young people, as well as people my age or a little older or a little younger, will find something in this. So yeah, I can be reached through my website, which is markvoger.com, M-A-R-K, V as in Victor, O-G-E-R.com, and it's markvoger@gmail is my email address, and I would love to hear. But I just hope you enjoy it and or have a look at it and see if it's for you. But it was a labor of love. It was just so much fun to put it out and put it together. And to me, the funnest part is when it's all in the final form.
Sure.
And and Christian, I'm sure you'll have your hands on your copy in a day or two, because
okay, well, they're
out there. Yeah,
that's great. Yeah, I can't wait to get it. No, I mean, the book is called Britmania. It looks, I mean, you know, it's arrived, get it as a Christmas present. I mean, it's not Holly Jolly, but it'll still make a great Christmas present. Your other book, Holly Jolly, which is all about Christmas. But again, the book is Brit Mania. It's out by Two Morrows Publishing. You could take a look at it at twomorrows.com. It looks great. I mean, I loved Holly Jolly. And I really like you, Mark Voger. Thank you so much for coming back onto the Part-Time Fanboy podcast.
I like you too, Christian Horn.
Thanks for getting back in touch. I hope it's not another 2 years, but I mean, if it takes you another 2 years to write another book, I'd be happy to have you back on.
Hey, I'll be here. As long as I don't die first, I'll be here.
Don't say that. Well, I mean, I appreciate it. I loved getting your email because you were like, oh, hey. And I was like, yeah, of course I remember you. Yeah, come back on. I would love to chat about the book. Yeah, that's great. So yeah, again, Britmania, twomorrows.com. This is Part-Time Fanboy. My name is Christian Horn. I have been chatting with Mark Voger. You can check us out, me, Part-Time Fanboy, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful social media stuff, which I say very sarcastically. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.